Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you took the time to download us and you're taking the time to listen. Every week, we bring you leaders in the field of sports medicine, exercise science, and general health, and we let them come and tell us about their passions and what they're doing and how they are improving and making different sports medicine. Today is no exception to that. We have Dr. Tom Welch with us today. He's from the Department of Dance Kinesiology at Florida State University. He's a professor there. He has his doctorate in psychology from the University of Kansas. And welcome to the studio today. You're visiting here at A&M this weekend, and we appreciate having you here.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate being here as well.
Super. So tell us what you're doing here.
I'm working with the dance department here, and they're launching a new program in dance science. Mm. And I just recently stepped down as president of the International Association for Dance Medicine and Science. So I was asked to come and help the students get some background that would be helpful in having them understand where they're headed in their degree and in their career. So that's my job today. Some of the work will be movement-based, and some of the work will be more lecture-based. It's pretty much a full day. I start with you this morning, then I go till about 5 this afternoon, and I'll finish with the faculty, and we'll see a performance this evening.
Cool.
Yeah, it's going to be a good day.
You know, I don't think many people associate the terms dance and medicine together. Can you help us explore that a little bit? And even dance and science, I don't think people – they think maybe – dance is a more creative art, and so they don't think much about that side of it.
Well, it's like sports and medicine. Mm-hmm. Sports and medicine is way ahead of dance and medicine, but they're basically following parallel paths. Mm-hmm. Dance and medicine are sister avocations, sister fields that
sure.
they work together just like sports and medicine do. And the types of things that dance medicine does for dance science and science does for dance are very similar to what sports science and sports medicine does for athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Dancers are athletes just as much as football players or basketball players. In fact, there was a study done in the 1970s that looked at physical activities, and it found that the very most strenuous physical activity was motocross motorcycle racing.
Mm.
Second on the list was ballet.
Wow.
Which was a big surprise to some people. But
right.
it's a very demanding profession. Some bodies can't tolerate it, and they decide to go do something else. Other bodies require some special training. But all the issues that are relevant to sports science are relevant to dance science. You have to worry
right.
about biases developing in the body, and you try to undo those biases. You have to figure out what the capacities are that each body needs to optimize their performance and minimize injury risk. So you're working on those as well. And
mm-hmm.
so you can kind of make a straight translation. And in fact, we do. Luckily, we have sports science ahead of us, and we can kind of follow what the sports sciences have done with athletes and do similar things with dance.
Right. And you mentioned biases. What are body biases?
Well, let's take a baseball player as an
sure.
example I like to use. So if you take a baseball player or a pitcher who's right-handed, they basically twist a lot to the left.
Mm.
So they use their left rotators of the spine, they use their right shoulder, and they actually develop a bias in their body.
Mm.
And that bias can end up creating problems later. So what you want to do with cross training is you want to try to figure out what those biases are and balance them out in a way that makes the body more healthy overall. Same thing happens in dance. So we tend to work on pointing the feet a lot, so we need to work on flexing the feet a lot,
mm.
dorsiflexing versus plantar flexing. We tend to turn the hips out a lot in dance, especially in ballet, so we need to work on turning them in to stretch the outward rotators, avoid sciatic nerve syndrome, for example. So you get the idea.
Sure.
It's basically trying to recreate balance in the body.
Sure. Yeah, I think early on in my career I got to work with some ballerinas in ballet, and we're amazed at the foot problems that they had and ankle problems.
Well, if you think about people standing on the ends of their feet, you can see why.
Yeah.
And what often people don't know is that the ballet shoes are basically cardboard. They're cardboard and cloth. That's what the ballerinas like the best because they shape to their feet. It's kind of like the way leather shapes your foot in a leather shoe, and synthetic materials don't. It's the same thing in ballet. So there have been some companies that have come up with some ballet shoes that are more supportive, that are higher tech, but the ballerinas don't like it because they don't shape to their feet.
Really?
Hopefully at some point in time that'll change. Both, I think there's going to have to be change on both sides in terms of the technology evolving to the point that it allows the sensations that ballerinas are used to, and ballerinas learning in these shoes that are more supportive and being able to manage that. So I think there's a little adaptation that has to go on in both.
Starts with the younger generation and moves up, maybe.
You'd think so, but of course they want to be like the older generation.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to break in and get the trends reversed. But I think it'll happen at some point in time.
Yeah, I'm going to ask maybe a naive question, and that is, how do they learn to stand on point like that? I'm talking about the ballerinas in particular that stand on the end of their toes. That just seems to be amazingly stressful.
Well, one of the things is timing. You can't do it too early. You can't do it before the bones reach a place where they can support the body. And the other is that you have to be strong enough to hold it. And, of course, young girls who train to be ballerinas all want to go on point because they aspire to be like their elders, the people they see that they want to dance like someday. So they all want to do it way sooner than they probably should.
Yeah.
It's usually around puberty that they should be making that transition. A good teacher will resist the influence from the dancers to try to get them to go on point, let them go on point sooner than what they really should. But the bones have to be in a place that they can support it, and the muscles have to be strong enough to hold them there.
Yeah.
And then they also have to have the right technique. So just jumping up onto point is one thing, but being able to do that 100 times or 1,000 times a day, because that's what you do in your training, you have to do it in a way that's healthy for your body. So that's part of what the technique training is. And dancers do, every day they probably do 1,000, at least 1,000 pliés in their training, and each one of those then can cause stress if it's not done properly, or it can cause them to get stronger if it is done properly.
Okay, I'm going to show my non-dance background. What's a plié?
A plié is bending at the knees, hips, and ankles. So it's a multi-joint activity, and every time you take a step forward, running, walking, you're doing some a plié at some point in that process. So that's why you can do so many of them. And I said 1,000, but it's probably more like 10,000 if you count a professional dancer who's taking class in the morning, rehearsing in the afternoon, maybe even performing at night.
Wow. You know, one of the things that I've seen is over the years, and my wife is a huge ballet fan, and so we've gone to a few of those. The thing that seems to distinguish early dancers from more accomplished dancers is how they can land without making noise, which is absolutely amazing. And I understand the stage has something to do with that. But even if you see the same performance in different venues, that the really accomplished dancers can land from these fabulous jumps without making very little noise.
I'm really glad you said that. I'm really glad you said that because that's one of my favorite examples for dancers as to why they need strength. Dancers often don't want to be strong because they think of the weightlifter who, when you tap him on the shoulder, he has to turn around to look at you, and they don't want to become bulky like that. But when I point out that it's the strength that really allows them to land without making a noise, then I can get their ear. They start to listen. So it's the ability to do that eccentric contraction, catching yourself on the very ends of the feet and then articulating down through the foot, through the ankle, through the knee, through the hip, and absorbing the shock gradually that allows the dancer to do it as though they're still on the cloud that they were in when they were up at the top of the leap, and you never quite see the bottom. So that's how they do it. It's primarily through strength, but it's a very refined and subtle strength because if you have to time it just right.
Mm-hmm.
If you stop with the metatarsal heads hitting the floor, you're going to make a sound. If you stop when your heel hits the floor, you're going to make a sound. So what dancers have to learn to do is modulate that eccentric contraction, the lengthening contraction, so that they can gradually let their weight go into the floor. And that's such a complicated activity that it's really hard to manage consciously. So we use a lot of imagery to get that to happen. The floating on a cloud, or landing on a cloud, or landing on a cotton puff, or landing on an eggshell so that you're not going to break it. And, wow. And all those different teachers use different analogies, but you're trying to get the dancers to engage in a complex motor activity that allows them to do things that seem virtually impossible.
Yeah, it's interesting that they can do that repeatedly. I'm just thinking most sports, they concentrate on making the jump, but they never talk about landing. I mean, there's somewhat with females to try to prevent some of the ACL injuries and so forth, but I think maybe dance is unique in that way, in that it really concentrates not only on the takeoff, but also there's so much emphasis on the landing, and it's got to be a very controlled landing.
Right, but there's another example of something that might be a good candidate for cross training, and that if you're doing high jump, or if you're doing broad jump, or I was a gymnast in my through college, and landing from the bar, all you had to do is not take a step from the high bar, the parallel bars, or whatever, not take an extra step, and then your point score would stay up. Well, I probably did some damage to knees and ankles and other joints by not landing properly. And had I really worked on landing, doing plyometric training, for example, then I might have been healthier still today than I am now. And I might have been might have actually landed them better, might have been able to land my jumps better. And it's been a while since I've been out of gymnastics. I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing plyometric training, like the work you talked about. I think it started at the Cincinnati Sports Medicine Clinic where they worked on with adolescent female volleyball players, and developed a whole jump training protocol that I believe has reduced ACL injuries by 85% or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a matter of what you have time for.
Sure.
But it's also the kind of thing that we have to look ahead and say, can I afford not to do it too?
Yeah. Do you see the same prevalence of ACL injuries in ballerinas that you see in some of the other women's sports?
My understanding is that dance is not a lot different in terms of activities. I would guess that volleyball and basketball would be a little higher because of the sticky shoes and the often landing and twisting, turning quickly. We have dance movements that do that as well, but we try to teach the dancers to control that movement. Use the hip muscles to keep the knees over the center of the foot as they're landing so that they're not causing a torque force at the knee between the tibia and the femur. I don't think there are necessarily any more of those. Much higher prevalence of lower extremity injuries in dancers, which you'd expect, than upper extremity injuries. That changes a little bit for male dancers who do a lot of lifting. Young male dancers tend to have some back issues because they're not quite strong enough to support the women that they're lifting. And if they're lifting women of the same age, they might even be bigger than them. You could kind of imagine, there are no real surprises in there, which you would imagine for other athletes. Tend to be true for dancers as well.
And that was going to be my next question. We've talked a lot about the ballerinas, but the males, I mean, and you mentioned that they have lower back injuries in particular. Any other particular, they don't have the same occurrence of foot and lower leg injuries as the ballerinas, do they? Or?
Well, probably not as much in the foot, but I would guess they have the same amount in Achilles, knee, Achilles and knee injuries, because they do all the leaping. While the ballerinas get lifted and they do a little bit of leaping, that's not their star activity. It's the males that are doing more of the leaping, so they're going higher, they're having to land more, they're doing more jumps per day. There's another reason that males get injured, and that's because they usually start later. I didn't start dancing until I was about a junior in college. I was a gymnast, and then I became a dancer after that, so it was very late to get started in it, and that's pretty common for males, where females start at 8, 9, 10 years old. Males start in their late teens often, and they often do a lot of catch-up. They try to do catch-up because they don't have the coordination, they don't know all the fine motor skills that they need, or the gross motor skills that they need to succeed in dance. So they take extra classes, they'll take twice as many classes thinking that that's the way to catch up. And some do, some bodies survive it, and some bodies don't. I should also say, though, that we've been talking about ballet as one form of dance. Mm-hmm. Modern dance or contemporary dance is another concert dance form. Mm. And it's less gender specific. So the dancers often, the females often lift people just as often as the males do, depending on the choreographer's preference. And the females dance just, or jump just as high and leap just as high and turn just as much, etc. So it's different in the modern dance in terms of injuries. There are fewer foot injuries probably in modern dance and more of the hip, low back, et cetera, injuries.
Yeah, I didn't mean to slight any of the other forms. It was just, you know, you talk about dance, many people, maybe I'm showing my bias, they go straight to the ballet. They think of ballet, and yes, there are all those other forms, and many of which we see even more often than ballet nowadays.
And I think it's a good place to start because it is so formalized and so recognizable as a trainable form. Mm-hmm. But we can go beyond ballet and modern to jazz dance, which is sometimes the legs are turned in, sometimes the movements are stylized in a way that doesn't match the training that the dancers had, because some of those came out of, many of the jazz dancers are formally trained as, or originally trained as ballet dancers. And then you go beyond that and you get to hip hop, you get to some of the street dance forms, you get to the spinning on the head, etc. So all those are dance forms. African dance is another form. Each one has its own stresses, its own unique challenges that dancers have to develop the capacity to manage.
Right.
And one of the challenges current day dancers face that previous dancers didn't face. In the old days, you dancers became a member of a company and pretty much stayed with that company through their life. Whether it was a ballet company or Martha Graham Modern Dance Company, Paul Taylor, or some of the other groups in New York City that have been around for a long time. And once you learned that choreographer's repertoire, then they were going to do more or less the same type of movement. Nowadays, dancers find it hard to find a full-time company job. And they often have to work in more than one company. When they work in more than one company, then they have to learn more than one repertoire. And one choreographer may like to turn left, the other one likes to turn right. They work with one for 6 months and they're good at turning left, and then they have to go and learn how to turn right with the other one there. And you could take that into all different types of skills and capacities that dancers would have to develop. And then work that across the different dance forms, African dance where you're bent forward, versus ballet where you're extremely vertical, hip-hop dance where you're turning yourself upside down and you're stomping your feet. African also uses some footwork. Irish dancing, where you're actually, and that it sounds like they're really slamming their feet against the floor, but they're not. If they did that, their joints wouldn't last. So they've learned when they first started how to make that sound with very little stress to their body. And somebody that goes out and just tries to do it and says, "Oh, I hear that sound, let's make that sound," is probably going to hurt themselves.
Right. Okay, I want everybody listening right now to jump up and try to do that sound, and you can relate to that.
Do it on a concrete floor. Don't do this at home, folks.
One of the things that we saw when we were doing some background work on it, that you used the Pilates reformer method. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And it appears to be intriguing.
Joseph Pilates was a pioneer in the field of physical therapy and all the forms that come after physical therapy, personal training, fitness training. And he was German, went to London during the war, and basically helped soldiers rehabilitate themselves after they came back injured from the war, their war injuries. And as he watched soldiers in the bed, he said, "Hey, you've got one leg that's bad. Why can't you be working the upper body? Why can't you be working your abs? Why can't you be working the rest of your body, keeping it healthy?" So he designed a whole system based around putting springs on hospital beds. And it was adaptive. He was looking for ways, how can I exercise these people even though they can't get up and walk right now? Instead of letting them be vegetables the whole time that the tissue is repairing, let's keep the rest of the body healthy. And what they found is not only did the bodies stay healthier and they came out stronger when they were done, but the tissue repaired faster too, because the body was more active, there were more things going on. So he came to the United States in the early part of the century and set up his own studio in New York City. And he was a boxer and a circus performer. And he was not strong, he was sick as a child, and so he was looking for systems that would help keep him more healthy. And he bought into yoga and used all the forms, he studied all the forms that might be helpful in terms of making himself stronger. And when he came to New York, he started his own creating his own methodology of training before there were any textbooks or any research really that we could fall back on. It said applied research in particular. How do you use what we know about how the human body adapts to stresses? How do you use that to create a stronger body so right. the body can tolerate more? And he developed this whole system. Dancers latched onto it because they needed something like that, and he was just down the street from New York City Ballet studio. So when Mr. Balanchine had an injured dancer, they'd tell him to go see Joe and go see Uncle Joe, and they'd see Uncle Joe down the street. He would get them back on their feet and have them dancing again, and it seemed almost miraculous. I've been doing it for since 1995, so I guess it's been a while that I've been at it, and it's evolved a lot. Poor Joe died before it became. He spent his whole life kind of wanting to do what Jack LaLanne did. People that might know Jack LaLanne, he kind of followed in Joseph Pilates' footsteps. So if you imagine somebody that was before him and a little bit quirkier, that would be Joseph Pilates. Unfortunately, passed away before his methodology got recognized in general practice. Now it's the hottest thing.
Right.
And dancers are staying with it because it serves them, but everybody else is starting to see the benefit for it too. The main difference between Pilates exercise and other fitness training is that if I go to a gym, much of the equipment is designed to isolate the muscles. So if I do a bicep curl on some type of a prayer bench, basically the bench is holding my arm up,
right.
and I'm just isolating my bicep to cause the flexion of the elbow. If I'm doing a Pilates exercise, I'm actually holding my arm out, so I'm using the shoulder, the muscles of the shoulder, I'm using the stabilizers of the scapula, I'm stabilizing the torso, I'm using my hip muscles. So it's working on the stabilization all at the same time you're working on that isolated muscle group. And then he's designed a whole set of exercises that integrate all the different body parts so that you start with the isolations and you go back and do these integrations. And the integrations are the integrated exercises are much more functional for human movement. So it's they don't look exactly like what we do, but if you look at them, you could say, "Oh, that's something." I'd less like lifting a box onto the top of the refrigerator. Oh, that's like picking up a case of records from underneath the stereo. Oh, that's like nobody will know what records are anymore.
Right? Those big plastic album things.
They're coming back. Uh-huh. They're coming back. I hear that turntables are the hottest thing now. So people are going to be back into vinyl before long.
That's right.
You remember that I told you that.
Okay. And our bit of nostalgia brought to you by.
So Pilates has caught on. A lot of dance programs have adapted it. The program here is a pioneering program. There are probably three or four that really have taken dance science as seriously as this program has. Most programs were dance programs first, and they have a little taste of dance science. My program is basically a Bachelor of Fine Arts and a Master of Fine Arts program. So people study to be choreographers or performers.
Mm-hmm.
And then they don't have much time left over to learn how to do science.
Science, yeah.
I get one or two out of our 120 majors who might be interested in doing it, and they'll do as much as they can, but they really can't get it under their belt while they're here. The program here is designed to teach people that piece of it, to teach them how the science aspect of it, and then they have the dance background and a passion for dance, and I think that could be a winning formula.
Yeah.
Cal State Long Beach is another program, and I think Goucher College and TAMU is probably one of the three that's kind of on the forefront of this. It's new, it's just evolving, but I suspect in 3, 4, 5 years it's going to have a reputation for having made a big contribution to helping the science move into the field of dance. You started earlier saying, what does science have to do with dance? What has everything to do with dance that it does to do with athletics?
Yeah.
It's just that dancers are only starting to realize that. It's programs like the one here at this university that I think are going to really help people experience. Dancers learn from experience. They you can tell them a bunch of times, but until they feel it in their body, they don't believe it. Athletes are the same.
People
telling me, hey, this is how you do a giant swing on the high bar. It wasn't until I felt it that I really believed it. Well, dancers are the same way. So if the TMU grads go out and they end up helping dancers, more dancers, feel what it's like to get their make their body strong enough so that they can land quietly on those leaps, so that they can do lots and lots of releves. Releve is going up plantar flexion. Plie was dorsiflexing. Releve is going up to plantar flexion. Of course, you have to accommodate with the knee and hip. So if they can do a bunch of those and stay in balance because mm-hmm. they're stronger, mm-hmm. if they get the range of motion so that they can kick their leg up to the side without pulling a hamstring, then they're gonna start to see that that maybe this science stuff does have something to benefit dance. And you also pointed out earlier that there's kind of a generational thing. It's everybody who's already a teacher and dancer had learned from the old school, kind of just keeps doing what the old school,
right,
because that's all
right.
they know, and they know that works.
Well, that's athletics and coaching in the same way. Yeah,
exactly,
absolutely.
Exactly. But I think if people from here go out and start to show them there is another way, then right. people are going to scratch their heads and say, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something else I can learn to benefit the dancers that I work with and keep everybody healthier and performing at optimum levels. Because dancers, just like athletes, train at those levels that are just at the edge of human perfection,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
you're trying to get to a level that's one step beyond what you did. One of my favorite sayings for progressive overload is do today one just a little bit more than you did perfectly yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another colleague who talks about it being on the growing edge. So mm-hmm. what you're trying to do is find the place where your body can tolerate, and you're going to push yourself just a little bit past that. You don't want to go over the edge down
right.
into the abyss, and
right.
you don't want to cause an injury, but you do want to be pushing yourself. You can't stay comfortable. You have to be challenging yourself all the time. And that's where I think the science can help with dancers, because they know that intuitively.
Right.
It's not
right.
that they're ignorant of that. It's just that they need that. Science, I think, can help them figure that out, do the titration that's required to be able to progress in a healthy fashion.
Yeah, and that seems to strike me. That's one of the interesting things about dance, is that when they have performances, they actually have, they don't have a lot of recovery time. I mean, you may have a performance every day for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 10 days, maybe even longer if you're on something like Broadway or whatever. So there's not the recovery time that a lot of athletes have. And I'm going to just erase the difference between athletes and dancers. I think they're all athletes, you know, when we talk about athletes. And so how do you manage fatigue? I mean, you mentioned that just a little bit there. How do you manage fatigue in these athletes?
It is a challenge. And our physical therapist, one of her major concerns is that dancers dance when they're fatigued, and
yeah.
they keep pushing themselves when they're fatigued. I'm working with a dancer who has a ruptured disc right now, and it's under. She didn't want to have it surgically repaired. She wanted to see if she could manage it conservatively. So we're working on doing Pilates training, and she's said that one of the things she's had to learn how to do is recognize fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And recognize when she was pushing herself beyond the point where she could really control her body in a way that kept it healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had a couple relapses. We've been working for about 18 months now, and so she's had a couple times when she's gone back, but each time she's come back quicker,
mm-hmm.
and each time she's gone less deep into the severe pain that made her incapacitated. And I'm optimistic that she'll be able to pull it off. She always, you know, reserves the possibility that she'll need a surgery at some point in time, but you know, if she can control it conservatively, then she's very strong. So this is not a person, not a dancer you'd look at and say that's a weak dancer. This is a very strong dancer, but she
right.
wasn't. She had a couple segments in her spine that weren't weak, that were hypermobile, and she didn't know quite how to control those, and that's where she was letting herself get fatigued. And once she got fatigued, then she had over movement those places, and that caused recreated the injury for her.
Wow.
So but there's one more piece if I may mention it, and that the other side of that is that the field doesn't understand periodicity in training and cycles. So that's one of my pleas to the next generation dance teachers that I'm teaching right now as students, is that you realize now what it's like when you get to the end of the year and how you feel. What you need to do is figure out how you're going to parcel that out, how you're going to arrange it so that your dancers don't get so fatigued and get to the place that they get injured. There's a study that was done about 5 years ago by a Greek Greek researcher, Yannis Koutandakis is his name, and he works.
You get extra points for being able to say that, by the way.
Luckily, I know him. He made sure I knew how to pronounce it. He's that type of guy. Looks like a coach. Looks like an athletic coach.
Yeah.
But he did a study where he had ballet dancers from the Royal Ballet in London in June. He had them come in, and the assignment was for the next 6 weeks, you may do nothing except go to the beach and shop. And he had done some pretest measures, so he measured a bunch of capacities, their respiratory and cardiorespiratory endurance, he measured their strength, he measured their range of motion, he measured their control of landing. Have them come back in 6 weeks. I may be off in terms of the weeks. It's between 3 and 6 weeks. But they came back, and the dancers improved on all those measures.
Wow.
And so the question I asked the dancers, what do you think happened? And they can all tell me. It's not that they really got better from going shopping and laying at the beach. It's that they were worn out at the end of the year.
Right.
And they came back to the place where their bodies were healthy after taking a little time off. Aha, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to think about that. They're going to need some help. That is an area that where our field needs some work. And unfortunately, our university in particular may have more challenge because we have so many opportunities for the students.
Mm.
And they're only there for a limited amount of time, so they won't take advantage of all those opportunities.
Right.
The dancers worked with one company at a time. They only had so much money they could pay them. They do 3 or 4 seasons a year. Those seasons might last 10 weeks, and then they'd go on unemployment. So there was a time that they were just taking care of their body.
Mm-hmm.
As dancers, as I said, are doing pickup companies now, and it gets harder to make a living. They're doing more continuous dancing, so that is becoming an issue. So that's a really good question you asked.
So our strength and conditioning colleagues that are listening, that there's a chance for collaboration. Reach out, go down the hall, and find your dance partners and talk to them about periodization in particular.
I think that's a very, very good point. And Martha Graham once said that it takes 10 years to make a dancer, and she was way ahead of her time. This was in the 1950s in that program, This I Believe. It was on the radio, and they're recreating that now. So the article they made out of that was called Athletes of God, and she was talking about dancers. It takes 10 years to make a dancer, and she talked about why that happened. We have a professor at our school by the name of Anders Ericsson, who's a psychologist. And he's from Scandinavia. And he says it takes 10 years to make an expert in any field.
Mm-hmm.
So any field that you go into, be it medicine, be it radio production, be it dance, be it baseball, it's going to take 10 years to make an international level athlete. So it's going to take some time to get to that level that everybody wants to get to. That means that dancers can't necessarily, people who are expert dancers can't necessarily take the time to be expert researchers,
right.
And expert researchers probably can't take the time to become expert dancers.
Right.
So the collaboration you talked about is a perfect way to do that. And there have been several. I worked with a dancer who was a ballet dancer at the University of Utah. We did a study on pelvic alignment. I did the research part of it. She did technique part of it,
and
we both knew some of the other, but she knew the most about the ballet. I knew the most about the research. We had another French exercise physiologist who worked with a ballet teacher in her country who was a New York City ballet dancer for a while, and then when he went back to teach at his school, and he knew that this certain image was helping his dancers. He intuitively knew it was helping dancers, but he couldn't prove it. He didn't have any way to prove it. So they worked together. Annabelle worked with Peter, and they did this study and showed that, in fact, it did change the way that the musculature engaged, and both in terms of the quality of muscular engagement, the hamstrings and the triceps serrated, gastroc soleus, and even the plantaris, they found that those muscles engaged more in a better timing pattern and also at a higher quality when they used this imagery that he was talking about. And they also looked then also at the range of motion, and they got deeper plies and more elevation when they left. So there's a collaboration. He knew nothing about research.
Right.
She knew, she just did dance as a hobby, and it was a perfect collaboration.
Yeah. So there's some motor neuroscience in there as well. Yeah. So we're running short on time. It's been a fascinating conversation. We always give our guests an opportunity to do a take-home message. If people are going to only remember one thing from this podcast, what do you want them to remember?
I, 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 I'd repeat a few things that we've already said. One is that dancers are athletes, and the challenges they face are just as stressful as any athlete faces. That they require the same type of prior training and preparation mm-hmm. that athletes require. That would be one thing. And another thing I would suggest is the idea of cross-training that we talked about, that any activity we engage in is going to create some imbalances, and we should spend some part of our time trying to rebalance our body. And the last thing I would say is that everything I said about dance is true about all human physical beings, because we're all movers. We all do play golf, we play handball, we play soccer, whatever it might be. We may just pick up the kids and carry them around the house, and we all need to take that same care in terms of the way we train our bodies, and to the extent that we can do it, I'd encourage us all to do that.
Excellent take-home message. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you for being here at A&M.
Thank you for letting me talk with you.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you all for taking the time to download and listen to us today. Our free T-shirt question for the day is, what was Pilates' nickname? Be the first one to email us that answer to that question at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. It's the same one we've used for the last year and a half. And you'll get one of those nifty free podcast T-shirts. Be the first one in your neighborhood. And don't think it's too late. Go ahead and send us the answer whenever you have it. Again, thank you, Tom, for being with us. And thank you all. And we hope that you all join us next week for another leader in sports medicine or exercise science. And in the meantime, we hope you stay active.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Kelsey Sachs and Cheryl Marek and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, providing voiceovers internationally. Music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.